HPPodCraft.com.
Had a good time at dinner tonight, since Sara had walked into town and brought back some wine. Medical note, I seem to be less allergic to cats when mildly intoxicated. We sat around the kitchen afterward playing poker for matchsticks. Very sinful indulgence, I understand. Sara and Deborah told me quite seriously that they'd have to say some extra prayers tonight by way of apology to the Lord. Theological considerations aside, though, we all had a good time, and Deborah managed to clean us both out. Women's intuition, she says. I'm sure she must have it. She's the type. Enjoy being around her, and not always so happy to trek back outside through the high grass, the night dew, the things in the soil. I've got to remember, though, that they're a couple. I'm the single one, and I mustn't intrude too long. So, left them tonight at 11, or actually a little after that, since their clock is slightly out of kilter. They have this huge grandfather-type clock, a wedding present from Sar's parents, that has supposedly been keeping perfect time for a century or more. You can hear its ticking all over the house when everything else is still. Deborah said that last night, just as they were going to bed, the clock seemed to slow down a little, then gave a couple of faster beats and started in as before. Sar examined it. He's pretty good with mechanical things, but said he saw nothing wrong. Guess everything's got to wear out a bit after years and years.
Ain't that the truth?
Oh my gosh. We're all wearing out. You know, every time you hear a sound effect on this show, like maybe a door creaking or a thunderclap, that's just my right knee. 98% of sound effects and almost all entertainment come from my right knee. That's just what happens when you get old.
Wow. It makes
panther sounds. I don't know what's coming. Well,
one thing that ain't getting old, this story.
No.
The events at Porth Farm. Over the next few weeks, we are covering Ted Klein's novella on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are here at HPPodCraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I am Chris Lackey. And with us again is our special guest, Ken Hite.
Hey, thanks again, guys.
Hey, man, what's going on? You got this Kickstarter still rolling, hey?
I do. It is still moving along. It is the Kickstarter for Tour to Lovecraft, The Destinations, the sequel to Tour to Lovecraft, The Tales, which you guys have been nice enough to plug and mention and say nice things about on the podcast before.
I love it.
This is the same thing, only instead of talking about the stories, it talks about the settings of the stories, all the locations from Arkham to Providence to hyperspace and beyond.
Oh, yes.
Laid out sort of longitudinally, so you can say, oh goodness, Lovecraft mentions Britain an awful lot. What does he mean by that? What's it doing there? Why is Rats on the Walls in England anyway? What's going on? And you can establish setting as a core part of Lovecraft, which of course it is, because Lovecraft is, as he says, as location-minded as a cat.
I'm so excited for this book to come out. I've made my wife promise to read it to me at night while I lie in bed as an anniversary present. But Ken, I'm so excited. Everybody, go out and support this thing. Already, it's blowing up. And if you miss out on it, you will be a sad person.
Please check it out. You know, and Ken and I were talking before the show, actually, and he made me cry. So let's do a little recap.
Okay, so far, this guy who's studying weird fiction is out on a farm. He's from New York. Farm is in New Jersey. He's got a little guest house he's in that's outside of the farmhouse.
Yeah, it's kind of a scare B&B. So there are lots of bugs out there where he's staying. he's keeping a journal about the experience of what happened, and we know that things ended badly somehow, but we're still at the beginning of the summer in terms of the journal.
The Porths are this kind of Amish-looking couple, Sar and his wife, Deborah. Nothing too strange has gone on yet.
No. So far, there have been some dinners. He's kind of attracted to Deborah. There's seven cats. One of them is particularly mean, but it's your average summer spent reading weird fiction out in seclusion. We ended last week with the entry of June 11th, and in that entry, he notes that some crickets paused for a beat, as if a hand had jarred the record or there'd been some kind of momentary break in the natural flow. And in that opening we just heard, by the way, read by our friend Andrew Staton.
Andrew.
You can catch him in the movie Clown Town, which is now streaming on Amazon. But this clock has been running for a century, and likely in that same moment when the crickets ceased, this clock somehow missed a beat.
And that provides our first indication in the story that it's not just Jeremy hallucinating from huffing spider poison.
Right.
Because he's been spraying spider killer insect poison inside his own house, and it's super powerful. So you are forgiven for thinking this is perhaps an unreliable crazy person telling the story. But the clock also skipped a beat at the same moment the crickets skipped a beat. Mm-hmm. And that gives you an indication that, yes, something big and cosmic, because it affected not just natural time, but mechanical time, mm-hmm. just happened.
Now we're at June 13th. Jeremy typically has his meals with the Porus, and they seem to get along pretty well.
We sort of went out last time on Ancient Sorceries, and in this section, he's talking about The Monk by Matthew Lewis. Both of those stories have in common a young narrator or a young protagonist. In Ancient Sorceries, it's a guy named Vezin who is telling his story to John Silence about this weird time that he had in a remote French town out in the middle of nowhere, obviously a parallel. And The Monk is about the monk Ambrosio, who is a young monk who is bitten by a serpent, because that was in a time before subtlety in 1796. And the nun Matilda sucked the poison out of his wound. Mm-hmm. Obviously, one thing leads to another. They get it on. What? And that is what sets Ambrosio on the road to the devil. Gives him the temptation.
Wow.
The reason that Vezin, on the other hand, stays in the tiny town is because he is obscurely fascinated, or perhaps in love, with a local girl in the town of Vezin. Oh. So both cases, we have a young narrator who is brought into a possibly compromising situation with a local woman. And although that's not a strong element in the story's events, Klein is letting you know that it's subtext, and he's setting you up with that same young narrator who in Ancient Sorceries falls in with cat witches, or in The Monk falls in with the devil. And of course, this being a modern story, or even postmodern perhaps, although it's pre-postmodernism, it sort of is all of those things at once.
June 13th, diary entry. Over dinner, they all realize that it's Friday the 13th day, and so they all wonder, hey, has anybody had anything unlucky happen?
They sit and talk about it for a second, and Sar goes, well, I got bit by something. They go, oh, did you? And he says, oh, yeah, yeah. At the front door of the house, there was a bunch of dead animals that the cats seem to have killed and brought to the door, which cats do.
Yeah, they keep bringing these things in as like tribute.
He said it was he was greeted to an unusual assortment of dead mice and moles. And there was this one body, he told us, that looked different from the others, rather like a large shrew, only with a mouth that was somewhat askew, almost as if it were vertical instead of horizontal, with a row of little yellow teeth exposed. He figured that, whatever it was, the cats had pretty well mauled it, which probably accounted for its unusual appearance. It was quite tattered and bloody by this time.
What's up with this creature? With the vertical mouth, is this some kind of weird alien, or, I mean, is this significant?
I think it is, for sure. And this might be the first manifestation of this thing from the other side.
I think if you have a shrew gug, that's probably that's probably important, right?
It is a gug, right? That's what I thought, too.
I mean, it's a tiny gug, a little guglet, but it's still not from here.
And it's a horror moment here, because he's never seen what this animal is before, thinks it's dead. When he goes down to pick it up, it bites him on the thumb and then runs off into the grass. So something that you think is dead coming, that's so scary.
And then the cats chase it to sort of begin the chain of events at Poroth.
June 15th, he says, something really weird happened today. I still keep trying to figure it out. He says, since it was Sunday, Sar and Deborah went into town to go to church. Jeremy is reading some Dracula. Ken, have you ever read that book?
I'm not familiar with that work. Who's that by?
This author, Bram Stoker. And he did...
Stroker.
That's the guy that did Jewel of Seven Stars. I did not know he'd done another book.
Lair of the White Worm. You know that one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, right.
That guy.
That's the same Bram Stoker.
I think it's Bram Stoker, because that movie Stroker Ace was the biopic.
That's right.
Yeah, it's about his time as a stock car racer, I think.
Exactly.
That's right.
So, yeah, Jeremy doesn't care much for Dracula. He says that...
Jeremy doesn't like Dracula.
Jeremy says, the soppy Victorian sentimentality began to annoy me. The book had begun so well on such a frightening note. Jonathan Harker trapped in the Carpathian castle, inevitably the prey of its terrible owner. That when Stoker switched the locale to England and his main characters to women, he simply couldn't sustain that initial tension. Damn!
Yeah.
That is cold!
A little sexist, too. Huh?
Yeah.
Also, I think that it does a couple of things. First of all, it sets up the notion of vampirism and possession and all the other things that Dracula means to us.
Ah.
It also, if you notice, this is the first time he's not able to finish a book, right?
Mm-hmm.
With
right.
Mysteries of Udolpho, of all things, he powers through it. He just forces himself into that 1794 mentality. And he's like, I'm going to get through it and I'm going to read it. He finishes The Monk.
Yeah.
How do you do that? But Stoker.
How does anybody do that?
Beautiful, perfect Bram Stoker. He can't get through. And we begin to now see that he is losing the capacity to be himself at this point in the story. I mean, as it go forward, so many books, I mean, we can't go into it because we'd be here all day.
Mm-hmm.
So many books he tries to read, but his eyes are watering or his allergies are too bad or, you know, something's happening and it prevents him from reading a given book. He gets distracted. He can't read. And so Bram Stoker is kind of that breakpoint for him where suddenly he's not able to start finishing a book. So we're saying something about the events that, yes, it's going to be a supernatural vampire possession story, mm-hmm. but also that he's losing the capacity that brought him out here in the first place. He is being sucked into the events at Poroth Farm. He's no longer a reader. He's no longer a spectator. He's going to become a participant.
So Jeremy is getting restless. So he goes for a walk in the woods down by the stream. He gets in the water and he makes some odd signs with his face and hands again, kind of doing that white people business that he did before.
The passes.
I don't know why. He gets a leech on his ankle from stepping in the water. He scrapes it off with a rock, but he feels kind of off. He says, physical helplessness is what he feels. And then he says, I felt that the woods had somehow become hostile to me, and more important, would forever remain hostile. Something had passed.
I followed the stream back to the farm, and that's where I found Boada, lying on her side near some rocks along its bank. Her legs were stretched out as if she were running, and her eyes were wide and astonished-looking. Flies were crawling over them. She couldn't have been dead for long, since I had only seen her a few hours before, but she was already stiff. There was foam around her jaws. I couldn't tell what happened to her until I turned her over with a stick, and I saw, on the side that had lain against the ground, a gaping red hole that opened up like some new orifice. The skin around it was folded back in little triangular flaps, exposing the pink flesh beneath. I backed off in disgust, but I could see, even from several feet away, that the hole had been made from the inside.
Uh-oh. So, when I first read this, I'm thinking, are we having some kind of chest-bursting alien thing here? Is that what's going on? There's some like little creature that got inside the cat and then burst out, and now it's going to grow into some kind of monster? We don't really find out what the hell this thing is. That's something that it's still quite mysterious what our monster is. We don't ever really know. And that's kind of one of the great things about this. Now, Jeremy says he's not bothered by the whole thing because he never really liked the cat, but he puzzles over what happened to it. And then he thinks, well, what should I do with it? Should I bury it? Should I go find the Poroths? Because, you know, they love their cats.
Yeah.
He does what I feel I might actually do in the circumstance, which is just pretend you didn't see anything. Because it's not really your problem.
Well, note to self, do not leave Chris alone with my cat.
Well, wait a minute. Now, if I have responsibility to watch an animal, I will take that responsibility very seriously. I love animals. But this is just some cat that lives on a farm where he's staying at. So his level of responsibility here is a little on the gray side.
And I think this is a really brilliant dramatic move. It's very relatable. I think anybody would have done this. Like, it's the most ordinary thing you could lie about. You go, this is not my cat. I'm not going to. But any lie can put you in a complicated position because if that lie is contradictory. It's so great because he's the only one that knows this cat was dead out here earlier. Mm-hmm. And he didn't report it. And it makes the next scene so great. but I also like this line where he says, besides, I felt strangely guilty the way one often does after someone else's misfortune, which I thought was a truth as well. That's like a human truth. When something goes wrong for somebody, somehow you feel like it's your fault, even if it's not.
Yeah.
The psychological realism of especially Jeremy, but also Sara and Deborah, is I think one of the things that makes this story that is, perhaps use the wrong word, more modern, more contemporary, because this is the post-Block era. We're inside the heads of all the characters now. They're not just Lovecraftian author surrogates to be eaten by Mego. They're genuine human beings with emotions and feelings and motives.
Yeah.
And obviously you get that in older horror fiction as well. But certainly by the 70s, it is de rigueur. And it, I think, is one of the things that Klein brings, is that sort of Stephen King writing characters you believe in sensibility, mm-hmm. but he marries it to this very old school sort of structure and plotting and concision in the story.
Yeah.
So Jeremy goes back to his cabin and he slogs through Stoker.
It's just hard for him to get through this book. And obviously I think it's the part where he realizes Dracula cooked that chicken for Jonathan Harker.
That must have held him up for what seems like hours.
Yeah.
The Poroths come back around 4. They make dinner. They still haven't gone outside. Jeremy goes in to eat, and Sar asks if Jeremy saw Boada, since the other cats were inside to be fed.
Right, and he's got to go through with his lie, mm-hmm. you know. It says, maybe she's just full, said Deborah, and laughed. That rattled me a bit, but I had to stick to my lie.
Yeah. And then he says, in the middle of our dinner came that scratching at the door. Sar got up and opened it, and Boada walked in.
Da-da-da.
Now, I know she was dead. She was stiff dead. That wound in her side had been unmistakable, and now it was only a reddish swelling. Hairless. Luckily, the Poroths didn't notice my shock. They were busy fussing over her, seeing what was wrong. "Look, she's hurt herself," said Deborah. "She's bumped into something." The animal didn't walk well, and there was a clumsiness in the way she held herself. When Sara put her down after examining the swelling, she slipped when she tried to walk away.
I gotta tell you, this was the moment I mean, I already liked this story.
Yeah.
But that just hooked me.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it's kind of an obvious thing. Maybe I should have seen it coming. But when the cat walked in, I was like legit scared as I was reading it.
What I really like about it is that I was misled earlier because it said that something popped out of it. It didn't say something popped into it. So that made me think that there was some evil thing in there and then the evil thing popped out and was running around.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case. So something popped out of it, yet this thing is running around. Like the cat has been healed somehow magically from this wound that he has perceived. Now we're dealing with maybe like John Carpenter's The Thing kind of creature here, maybe? And that there's something else outside running around, maybe?
I think that as we go forward, it becomes apparent that your original sort of alien notion is the one that it goes into you, and then it comes out of you, and then it goes back into you. That we've got a case of possession. And what I think happened is Wada caught the gug shrew. She ate the gug shrew because she's a good cat. And then the gug shrew burrows its way out of her, like the rat thing in Dreams of the Witch House, out of Gilman. Then goes back in and animates the corpse, is what I think happened. But yes, it is a great, great moment in the story. And it's before, I think, Pet Sematary even. So you're reanimated creepy pet.
Yeah.
Right there.
So Jeremy is second guessing himself because this makes no sense. No sense at all. It had a big old hole in it. That thing was dead. I'm sure of it. But then maybe I was wrong and I didn't see what I thought I saw. Man, this is just some good horror stuff.
I like the cat. Her movements were stiff, tentative, like a newborn animal still unsure how to move its muscles. So we're being told that something's faking it.
Yep.
Also, the cat seems to be staring at Jeremy.
Yeah.
I mean, cats look at people all the time, but is this his paranoia coming in here? Is this from maybe his insecticide inhaling evenings that he has here? Is this that type of thing?
Well, certainly he goes back and he huffs some more, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
Yeah.
Jeremy goes back to his room. He finds a big ass spider and he sprays it like crazy. Sar said that the room smells like bug spray when he walks in. And Jeremy goes, "Oh, I didn't notice." So again, he is getting used to the smell of bug poison because it is so infused to his body, I'm guessing. Again, it feels like that this gives us that plausibility of an unreliable narrator.
Possibly.
And the great thing is it comes right after he's tried to give himself plausibility and the reader has immediately rejected it. When he's like, "Oh, maybe the cat did just topple over in a fit and then wake back up. I'm not a veterinarian. I don't know anything." And the reader's going, "Oh, you liar. You know that there was a dead cat and it's come back to life." And then we immediately have, "Oh, but he's been huffing bug spray all night."
Uh-huh.
Maybe we don't know that. Mm-hmm. But it sort of sets it up and then it undercuts it in that great rhythmic way that Lovecraft was so great at and that Klein is also so great at.
Well, I love that moment too. It says that while he's trying to read Dracula, but he keeps being distracted by this moment that happened after dinner where he was looking at the cat and he said, "Hey, Sar, look at Wada. That damn cat's not blinking." And then the cat blinks.
Yeah.
The cat, it knew what he was talking about and it goes, "Oh, that's something that a cat should do, huh?" Very creepy. I love the line where he goes, "I hope we can get to the vet tomorrow because I want to ask him whether cats can impale themselves on a rock or a stick." I want to hear him ask a professional that question.
June 17th, the cat is doing fine. The hair is growing back over the patch. Now it's walking fine. And that is really disturbing that wound and the hair would grow back so quickly. He said he's reading some La Fenu green tea, which we did cover on the show.
We did.
There you go.
We're not total incompetents here. And The Familiar, which we haven't covered.
No, we haven't. I've got it in a doc. We haven't put it on the schedule yet, but we'll cover The Familiar at one point. Green tea had the phantom monkey in it.
He says here about The Familiar and has a little staring man who drives the hero mad. So I think that sounds like what Ken's saying. It's kind of relating to what's going on our story. We've got not a staring man, but a staring cat.
And this is where Jeremy just comes right out and tells you that that's what Klein's doing because he says, "Not the smartest choices right now, the way I feel, because for all the time that fat gray cat purrs over the porous, it just stares at me." And so he's just underlined it and highlighted it and said, if you weren't reading all of this callback as scene building. Start reading the scene building, people. I can't keep holding your hand the whole time. He just lays it right out there. And of course, Lefanu is great. The green tea is about a spectral thing that only the narrator can perceive that haunts him. Again, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about, is this a thing that only Jeremy can perceive? Mm-hmm. Right now, Jeremy's the only person who knows it's going on or even thinks it's going on. But is it an unreliable narrator? Because, of course, the title green tea comes from the diagnosis that is applied to the guy, is that the only thing that happened to him is he drank a lot of green tea and got his nerves all shot. Uh-huh. He had an overdose of green tea. That's what made him crazy. And so we can dismiss it. And that is where he's saying, it's the great unreliable narrator story. I am an unreliable narrator, but I'm not.
Now, well, he is feeling very paranoid, and I would too at this point. And I would honestly think I was losing my mind, because I'm not the kind of person that goes in for these things. I would be a horrible protagonist for a horror story. I'm one of those guys who gets killed early on so that the protagonist can see what the actual threat is and that it's real.
Yeah.
Because if something supernatural happened to me, I would just assume that I was going nuts. I would not go, oh, that's a real supernatural thing. A
lot of this story.
Exactly.
Chad's like, hey, is Chris staring at me? And then I look at you and blink. And
while he was petting one of the cats, it says he came away with a tick on his arm, which he didn't discover till taking a shower before dinner. As a result, I can feel imaginary ticks crawling up and down my back. And of course, as I was reading this, so could I.
All right, yeah.
The minute that you suggest an infestation, everybody can feel it. It's the worst, you know. And so much of this story is about infestation. The bugs that are trying to get into his room, and actually what happens here is some sort of alien infestation. It's powerful stuff, man.
Now into June 21st, and he's reading The Uninhabited House and Monsieur Maurice, as well as The Amber Witch. Novels, again, which we don't really cover on our show.
Here it says, and Deborah was wearing one of the few sleeveless dresses I've seen on her. So she has a body after all.
Whoa.
You know, and when he says that, it was funny. Because in the last episode, I said that this was under the surface. But when I reread this, I go, no, it's pretty obvious. But again, it could be that office elevator syndrome. You know, if you ever get stuck in an elevator and then you look around and go, all right, who am I going to mate with? I think that it's just he's stuck out there. Yeah. So, you know, he's finding himself attractive.
I can't let Chris watch my cat, and I can't get in an elevator with Chad. I'm learning so much.
I was thinking about how many times I've been alone on an elevator with Chad now, and I'm feeling a little uncomfortable.
Well, maybe you should be flattered, Chris.
Of course. But I was the only person in the elevator. So the strange thing on this day is after dinner, Jeremy and the Porths are watching the news. Poirot comes up and sits at his feet and seems to be watching TV. Deborah comments on this with your typical, oh, it thinks it's people kind of comment. But then the cat looks at Jeremy and he looks him right in the eyes.
Yeah, I know how to watch the news, motherfucker.
But I really like this here, too, because cats watch TV. I've had cats in my life and they'll watch TV just like a person will, because it's a thing that's moving. There's lights, there's sound. Not really that weird of a thing, but in the context of this whole story, it becomes weird and supernatural and creepy. It's a rainy night, and the mildew continues to grow up the walls in his little shack. June 22nd, he is wandering around the farm. Jeremy sees Wada getting very aggressive with the other younger cats. He tells the Porus about it, and he asks if they noticed that maybe, you know, she's gotten worse lately.
And there was an Edward Gorey reference here. Well, which struck me, you know, we read such old stuff that it was crazy to me that popped in.
But then he realizes that when he asks about the cat or makes this comment, that he drops his voice as if someone might be listening in, like the cat.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes back to his room at the end of the night and notices his bug spray is missing. And he thinks Sar might have borrowed it and forgot to bring it back. And then he's annoyed that they came in and took something out of his room without his permission.
Of course. Well, he assumes that's what happened, but let's speculate on what really happened. Did the cat break into his...
Yeah.
Did the cat break in and steal his bug spray?
I don't know, because that doesn't make any sense. A cat can't pick up a can of bug spray.
Wada's a big old farm cat. Cats can do a lot. If Virgil wanted a can of bug spray, he could easily pick it up, I'm sure.
But in his mouth?
Not necessarily in his mouth. Well, he'd tug on the thing that the nozzle.
Oh, okay.
Which you use to spray with, okay. Right? There's okay. Things that are smaller than a cat's mouth that come off of a thing of bug spray.
Okay.
And even if it's in one of those deals with the handle that you pump, you can grab the handle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a cat can definitely drag the bug spray around. And I do want to point out that at the very beginning of the story, they mentioned polluted well water.
Yes.
So let's leave that lie and go forward.
It is true. Cats can do a lot of stuff. My grandpa got mugged by a cat. There's this part here where he tries to read some Walden, you know, to kind of distract himself from the horror stuff. but he finds his eyes too irritated and watery. And that's in that's kind of what you were talking about before, right, Ken?
Yeah, and then specifically, Walden is about a man who's living alone in the wilderness and discovering existentialism and truth and beauty and all that other transcendental nonsense. Uh-huh. He can't do that. He can't go to the nice wilderness, the paradise of Walden Pond. He is banned from there mm-hmm. by his own actions and by the Shrugug and by allergies.
Or bug spray. June 24th, he writes about how last night he was woken up.
At first, it sounded like something in the woods near my room. An animal, a child, I couldn't tell, but smaller than a man, shuffling through the dead leaves, kicking them around as if it didn't care who heard it. There was a snapping of branches and every so often a silence, and then a bump, as if it were hopping over fallen logs. I stood in the dark listening to it, then crept to the window and looked out. Thought I noticed some bushes moving back there in the undergrowth, but it may have been the wind. The sound grew farther away.
Now, having read this whole story, this doesn't sound like the cat. He says child, and he says feet getting stuck, slogging through the mud. This sounds like something big.
When I read the story, I just think that it's the cat, and the reason its feet are getting stuck in the mud is because it's still getting used to walking on things. Mm. And that's what he's hearing. But you could also maybe say that it's some other presence from the woods that has been called up by all of this.
Yeah.
Because he talked about the footprints of the animals around that pool in the woods earlier and how it's sort of this sacred place. Mm-hmm. And then he goes and he tries to do his little gestures, but it doesn't work. I think that's because something else has moved into that ecological niche of that pond.
Yeah.
Something big and powerful. And maybe it's maybe it's another entity. Maybe it's just all the creatures in the woods that are moving around together because they're being drawn in. Because like the next paragraph, he talks about how he hears wails and caterwauls from deep inside the woods. Mm-hmm. Doesn't know if it's humans or animals. That there was an impression of singing in the rhythm of the prayers,
right,
of the Porth's prayers. Maybe all the animals of the forest are sort of gathering because they're being drawn mesmerically or magnetically to this place. Maybe it's a bobcat or a bear or something that's out there just sort of being haunted. And maybe it's just a way to remind you, the reader, that, oh, we're in the middle of the woods. Everything outside is creepy as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But I do like the fact that it throws us something else. When you read the story, these are all possibilities, but we don't ever know at the end of the story what the heck actually is going on or what happened. And all of these like little things that go on add to the weird. They make it feel strange and uncomfortable and alien. And if we were able to label it as something, that gives us control, and us not being able to know exactly what's going on, that makes it scarier. At least for me, it does.
When this happened, he was reading Walter de la Mare, who we covered his story, Seton's Aunt.
Oh, love Seton's Aunt.
And we're actually going to be doing more of his stuff coming up. In fact, in November, it'll be all de la Mare stories all month.
All right.
So we'll find out.
Delamere member.
That's what they're calling it.
Or Novellamere.
That's what they're calling it on the street. There was a line in here I liked. It said, I had no intention of going out there with my flashlight in search of the intruder. That's only for guys in the movies. that almost sounded like, and we referenced Salinger in the last episode, but that kind of sounded like a J.D. Salinger Catcher in the Rye sort of line. You know, I like how in that book, the protagonist is always thinking about himself in context of a film or a movie. I like when he pushes up against these tropes a little bit.
Yeah. Jeremy calms down and he goes back to bed, but then he hears that sound that Ken was talking about, that high-pitched wail, mm-hmm. the caterwauls from deep within the woods. That night, he brings it up with the Porths over dinner. Sar looked concerned, and he went to consult some of his books, and Deborah thinks that mm-hmm. the two sounds might have been unrelated. The first, a wild dog, and the second, some kind of whippoorwill or something. Whippoorwill reference. Or an owl, maybe. And then he says something strange here. He goes, I've heard the howl of wolves, and I've heard the hounds baying at the moon, and both have the same element of, I suppose, worship in them that these did. Mm. Sar couldn't find what he was looking for, having burned a bunch of his books in a fit of piety, he says.
Well, it's actually not his books, I think, that he burned. It says a lot of old books he'd found in the attic.
Ah.
So when they came into the space, I think there were already some books there. So what's going on with that?
Ooh.
You think there was a Lovecraftian library up there?
Oh, could have been. I didn't catch that.
The Porth farm, because remember, they bought it. It's sort of this rundown place. No one else has got it. The ground is obviously haunted by the possibility of this presence, mm-hmm. at least, because you can just do little gestures and open up the door. I think, yeah, there was a Lovecraftian attic up there and a whole list of everything from the Pnacotic manuscripts down to Azathoth and others. And mm-hmm. Porth just said, nope, we're not having that paragraph in the story, and just threw it in the fire.
Exactly.
Sorry, August Derleth, but we just don't have time
not
for
litany
this.
Of scary books. We're not getting that in this.
But it's referenced, you know, which is genius. It's genius.
But Jeremy looked in his field guide to mammals and saw that foxes and coyotes still could be found in New Jersey. And he also looked up the night, mm-hmm. the 23rd of June, which is when this happened, and that's St. John's Eve, or St. John's Eve. I'm not sure if that's how it's supposed to be pronounced. Mm-hmm. Sabbats likely is what it says.
That's in Barbara Byfield's Glass Harmonica.
The Glass Harmonica is kind of a collection of miscellany and tropes. It got republished as a book called The Book of the Weird, which is the form in which I own it. It sort of has, if you've read Diana Wynne Jones's Rough Guide to Fantasyland, mm-hmm. it's kind of like that in that it's making fun of the tropes of gothic literature and horror fiction and fantasy, but it's also sort of inhabiting them. And in the course of making fun of them, it also says, oh, hey, if you're a witch cult, here's when you're meeting and things like that. It's sort of a guide and a parodic commentary at the same time.
Okay.
And again, is very similar in sort of orientation, though not in effect, because it's funny and not creepy, to this story where it's commenting on itself even while it's taking part in what it's commenting on. Mm-hmm. It's a great book. I mean, as Book of the Weird, you can probably find it still relatively cheaply. And it's great fun, and the illustrations are fun and goofy. It's an odd thing to see just sort of show up here. It's not even like you looked it up in a Llewellyn Field Guide to Witchcraft or something. You looked it up in a silly, metafictional, almost children's book. Mm.
Well, also, I thought this was really clever. Here it says, when he looks that up, it says, sure enough, my hunch was right. Looked up June 23rd, and it was St. John's Eve. So that's the first time we learned that the main character is a hunchback.
And that his hunch talks to him.
And his hunch talks to him, which I thought was a really powerful thing to just pack into one little clause. He also makes a reference to the Wolfman here. Some more cinema stuff, right? He says, werewolf weather, as Maria Uspenskaya might have said, who is the, you know, she's the gypsy woman in the Wolfman.
Oh, right, yes.
Right.
June 25th, hot day. So Jeremy goes to take a cold shower. When he opens the door, Boada runs out. He asks Deborah about it, and she explains that Boada was getting violent with the other cats, so Sara locked her into the bathroom to punish her. It says he had been bitten once and scratched a lot on his hands, but not badly. Maybe the cat still likes him best.
He says the devil had gotten into his cat, and it was obvious he meant that quite literally. Sara has kind of a good idea what's going on, too, maybe.
Well, we know that Sar wanted to look something up in the Necronomicon or in Donnell's Brecklick and Colton, and he's like, oh, I burned that. I don't even have the glass harmonica to look things up in.
Jeremy says that the cat seems to be fine now and getting along with the other cat, so it worked off its rage, he guesses.
I guess.
He complains about the Porths again because stuff in his room seems to have been moved around. It might have been because Deborah had come in to clean off the mildew on the wall, but he's not sure. He now decides to hide his diary under his mattress because he thinks maybe somebody was reading his journal.
And at the end of that journal entry, he says he's been reading some Northanger Abbey. He says the really quite witty, but it's obvious the mock gothic bit isn't central to the story.
Obviously, Northanger Abbey is Jane Austen's, one of her great novels, and it's about the main character who believes that she is in a gothic novel, even though she's not. And that's the joke. Now, The joke within the joke is he has now made up a story about Deborah Porath being into him, right? He said she's snuck in to read my diary and find out if I love her. But I don't. I only love literature. Sorry, babe.
Right.
And then he puts his diary under his mattress so that Deborah can't find it and read about her sleeveless dress. He's fooling himself that Deborah is into him.
Sure.
Just like the Jane Austen character is fooling herself that she's in a gothic novel, but he's in a gothic novel.
Right.
So while he thinks he's in a romance, he's actually in a gothic. Jane Austen's character thinks she's in a gothic. She's actually in a romance.
There you go.
This story is so good. Well, you know what? We're running out of time here. So I think we're going to have to punt the conclusion of the story to next week.
I'm so much loving this. And Ken, your insight has been invaluable.
Klein brought it. All I did was put it in a row.
I want to once again thank our reader, Andrew Staten, for doing such a great job.
Andrew, you are a genius, and I want everybody to run to Kickstarter right now. I know it's on the internet, but just run to wherever you find the internet and back Ken's project, Tour de Lovecraft, The Destinations.
Do it now. And that's all we have for this week. We'll be back next time. I have been Chad Pfeiffer.
I am still Chris Lackey.
And I remain, as always, Kenneth Hite.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
On HP Podcraft.com.
HPPodcraft.com.